Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. We carry our work on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. We're pleased to share this event with Sheila Heady and Molly Cross Blanchard from our 2024 Insight Series, presented in partnership with the Vancouver Public Library. For those who are new to Insight, it typically runs every other Wednesday from January until the end of May, in person at the library's central branch in downtown Vancouver, and live streaming across Canada and beyond. To discover other past and upcoming Insight events, you can visit our website, writersfest.bc.ca. Sheila Heady is the author of 11 books, including Motherhood, Pure Color, and How Should a Person Be? She was named one of the New Vanguard by the New York Times, a list of writers who are shaping the way we read and write fiction in the 21st century. She joined us to discuss her latest book, Alphabetical Diaries, in conversation with writer and editor Molly Cross Blanchard, who's the author of the poetry collection Exhibitionist. This event was recorded live on February 21st, 2024. We'd like to thank our Insight partner, the Vancouver Public Library, as well as our public sector funders, the Government of Canada, the Canada Council for the Arts, the Government of BC, the BC Arts Council, the City of Vancouver, and CMHC Granville Island.
Perfect. Hi, welcome to Insight. Thank you for coming. My name is Molly Cross Blanchard. Thank you so much, Leslie, for the introduction. And thank you to Jorge for the thoughtful land acknowledgement. I'm a little nervous. It's not lost on me what a privilege it is to be the person sitting up here and getting to pick the brain of a very innovative and bold, impactful voice on literature. And I'm very excited for our conversation. I think it's going to be incredibly inspiring to me and to everyone in the room tonight. Yeah. I'm going to read an excerpt from the event page to give you a bit of a context for our conversation tonight in case you aren't totally familiar with Alphabetical Diaries and what it is accomplishing. A little over a decade ago, Heady began looking back at the diaries she'd kept over the previous 10 years, searching for signs of deeper change inside herself. She loaded all 500,000 words of her journals into Microsoft Excel to order the sentences alphabetically and seek out patterns and repetitions. With the sentences untethered from the narrative of her diaries, she started seeing herself and the self in a new way. The result is something fresh and sublime that the New York Times called a profound experience. Welcome, Sheila.
Thanks.
So I'd like to start with a very simple question, which is, when did you start writing a diary?
When I was a little child, I had a Ramona Quimby diary. I don't know if anyone had that diary.
Mine was Lizzie McGuire.
Lizzie McGuire. Was it like a fill-in-the-blank diary?
No, it was like almost like a flip-up notebook. It was very flimsy. It's falling apart now, but I cherished it.
Yeah, mine was like a fill-in-the-blank diary. So, you know, the worst thing that's ever happened to me is, you know, and then there's a space, and when I grow up, I want to be, and then a space. And yeah, so I think that was like grade three or something.
So how did your diary writing process evolve from fill in the blank diaries to something that maybe felt a little more serious or self-reflective maybe?
I'm not exactly sure. I think in my early 20s, when I moved to Montreal, I started keeping a diary. I had a typewriter and I would type up my diaries on my typewriter. And then, you know, for this book, the diary started in 2005 when I started writing How Should a Person Be? Mm-hmm. And I've always kept my diaries on my computer because I find writing by hand, my handwriting's illegible. if anyone who comes to the signing will see. And also just It's just easier. Like I didn't want to make it a precious thing. So I would just open a Word document, right? And I never kept a diary in a daily sort of way. It's just whenever I need to think through something, you know, there's the diary to sort of think through something.
So did you, from the 2005, when you started writing the entries that would appear in alphabetical diaries, were you writing with a reader in mind, or were you writing sort of in a vacuum, as in these words are just for me, no one is going to see them?
Yeah, I didn't think that I was going to make a project of it.
Yeah. So what was the moment when you realized that the private writing would become public writing?
Well, in 2010, after I finished How Should a Person Be, I think that I just felt this, after you finish a project, there's just nothing in your life to think about or do. And it's a very empty, lost kind of feeling. And I just thought, I need a project right away. And I had, you know, 5 years of diary writing on my computer. I later added more to it. And I thought, what if I use this? What if I play around with this? Maybe I can understand something about the past years. Maybe I can understand if I've changed. Maybe I can see my repetitions and patterns. So when I put the sentences into Excel and alphabetize them, that was the way I wanted to look at them, just to see if there's repetitions and patterns and so on. And I wasn't thinking about it as a project for an audience. I was just thinking about it as a project for myself to learn about myself and to think about, well, I was just also curious, like, how would it read? Like, how would it read if you put 5 years of journals into alphabetical order? Like, how many times had I said, I hate him? You know, how many hymns were there in that hymn, you know?
Was there another project in the world or another writer you had read that sort of clued you into what your own diaries could be if they were put in alphabetical order? Or did it come from some other sort of impulse?
No, I don't think so. The only book that I would say made me think that this would be interesting is, there's a writer named Kenneth Goldsmith, and he's sort of an experimental writer. He's more of like a conceptual artist. And he did this project in the 90s where he would wear a microphone around his, not a microphone, like headphones around his neck, but instead of it playing music, it was a microphone. And so he taped everything he said for a full week. And then he transcribed, you know, every chapter was a different day of the week. Monday was every word he said from the moment he woke up to the moment he went to sleep. And he didn't edit it at all. There was all the ums and ahs, and there was no paragraph breaks. So you never know when he's like talking to his wife, and then when he starts talking to the dog, and then when he starts talking to the taxi driver. So it's a soliloquy, if you say, what have I said all week? And he was in the art world, so there's full of gossip. I think when the book came out, people were very upset because of all the gossip. He didn't change any names. And the book is like 1,000 pages long. There's actually a PDF of it online. It's been out of print for years, but it's called Soliloquy by Kenneth Goldsmith. And you can't really read it because it's unreadable. And so it's just really boring, but it's kind of a fascinating idea. You know, it's more like an interesting idea than an interesting read. And so when I started this project, I think I was like, oh, maybe that would be interesting in the same way that Soliloquy is interesting, where it's this comprehensive, unreadable, extremely long document, not of a 1 week, but of 5 years or 10 years, you know, eventually it was 10 years. And then it took me more than a decade to move away from it being a conceptual art project to being a novel. So like, you know, am I allowed to break my own rules? Am I allowed to edit? Am I allowed to make it interesting for people to read? It took a long time to say yes to that.
So you did say yes to being able to break your own rules.
To be able to edit and to be able to, not that I edited the sentences exactly, but I cut a lot of sentences and to start editing for rhythm and for humor. And so it's not just, to make it something separate from proof of a concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you edit within individual sentences, or was it more the sequencing of the sentences that you gave yourself permission to edit?
Well, every sentence is in alphabetical order in the sense there's only one place in the book each sentence can be. So there's the first letter and then the second letter and the third letter and the fourth letter. So there's no moving sentences around. So the only kind of editing I could do was to cut. So if I have if I have 10 sentences in a row, you know, I can cut sentences 2 to 9 and then sentence 1 and 10 beside each other make a really interesting chemistry, you know? Or sometimes I would make a sentence shorter in order for there to be a nicer flow. But that was the only kind of editing I really let myself do.
I imagine that Kill Your Darlings process would be really tough if you're seeing sentences that are fairly far apart on the list that work so well together, but there's something in the middle that you just think there's something magical about that, and you have to get rid of it to make that other connection. That would be really tough.
Yeah, that was kind of the game of it.
Yeah. Do you have sort of a graveyard document where you've kept all of your favorite lines about to disappear?
No.
You're just gone. Yeah. Don't want to think about it.
Well, I mean, there's so many drafts of the book. There is an 80,000 word draft that I really love. This one's 55,000. There's a 65,000 word draft that I really like, you know? And there's times when, you know, my American editor, I gave her the 80,000 word draft and she said, it has to be shorter. And so I made it, I think, 50,000 words. And then my UK editor said, it has to be longer. So I made it longer. And like, but it was really a question, like, how long should something like this be? Mm-hmm. And I think in the end, it just came down to like how much repetition is interesting and then how much is boring, you know, and like trying to keep it on the interesting side.
Yeah. So you worked on this book for 10 years. How do you decide when to stop? When to stop tinkering with it?
I think at a certain point, I just couldn't do it anymore. One of the hard things about this towards the end was trying to remember with a straight narrative, you remember everything that happened in your book because you think, well, here are all the scenes through the narrative. But when it's just individual sentences, it's really hard to remember what sentences are in the book. And so I had these 2 weeks when I was editing when I really felt like I was able to keep a sense of all the sentences in the book. And then I came back, I went on a trip and I came back and I just thought, I can't do that ever again. Even though I wanted to make it longer, I didn't feel like I could take another 2 weeks and just like hold them all in my head in that way. Yeah. So I was like, it's done.
Yeah. I'm really curious about that process of cutting down from 500,000 words to 60,000 words. And sort of whether there was an initial culling of certain sentences that maybe you disqualified by the quality of them or the topic of them, or if there was a way to kind of shrink that data to a more manageable size. What made something sort of immediately obviously cuttable?
That it didn't make sense out of context. Mm. So like every sentence in the book kind of makes sense even though it's not in a context. Also, some sentences just weren't interesting. They had nothing interesting about them. There was like no beauty. There was nothing to them. So that those were the ones that cut. And sometimes there was just actually way too much repetition. Like how many times can you put the same thought in so many different ways?
Yeah. This is a sort of personal curiosity because I tend to also write quite personal narrative, but there is still a sense of nervousness and anxiousness, especially when you're writing about other people. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel that confidence in the work or that security, I guess, in sharing so much of yourself?
Well, it is myself that I'm sharing. I mean, I changed the names of my friends and I sort of blurred their identities. Like the characters in the book are kind of composites of people. They're not, it's not like this is this person, this is this person. I wouldn't have published that book because that's not really fair to anybody else, but I can be unfair to myself. I just don't think we're all so different from each other. So I don't really feel nervous I feel nervous, but I don't feel ashamed. Like I feel scared, but I don't feel exposed. Like I think what a person exposes in their writing is just what all of us have inside us. So it doesn't feel, I don't feel like I'm under a microscope, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that is a very freeing thought. So you did change the names of friends and family.
Yeah. And made them kind of archetypes. So if like through the years there was like, you know, the guy that I liked at any one time, I made a few characters into the guy
as being you, or whether you see it as a separate speaker, separate from yourself.
It's being published as nonfiction in the UK and fiction here, so it's kind of confusing. I think it is me. I think it's me from a long time ago. You know, But it does feel like me. Like with my other books, I do have a sense of like, even if the character's named Sheila, it's still a character. And this is so much not a character as much as like me at a different time in my life slightly. But I think that was what was a bit nerve-wracking about publishing it, because, you know, and letting my boyfriend read it and my best friends read it, because I don't know what kind of person is being revealed. And that was kind of scary. You know, like when I showed it to my boyfriend, I had this feeling like, is he going to not like me anymore? You know, I mean, we've been together for like more than a decade, but still it's like a diary is a different self than any other self. But we're still together. So that worked out okay. And I kind of feel like maybe there's, and I was thinking in the reviews, are people going to say, you know, this is a narcissist or this is a selfish person or this is like a, whatever you are afraid of if somebody was to read a diary. But I think there's a certain liberty, like in a diary, like mm-hmm. you are writing about yourself in a diary mostly.
Yeah. Would you be willing to do a little bit of a reading for us?
Yeah.
Awesome.
You mentioned the characters, and I think I'm just going to I'll read some of the character Lars so you can get a sense of it was fun to make the characters. And then I'll read another part. Lars and I went into the woods. Lars cannot be with me. Lars could have called me at any time today. Lars doesn't answer my emails. Lars doesn't listen to you or pay attention to you or even let you speak. Lars doesn't love you in that way. Lars doesn't want a life with you. Lars doesn't want to be with you for all of the many reasons I have not wanted to be with men. And I never thought of those men, well, if they'd done this a little differently or not done that, things would have been different. But rather that things might have been somewhat different, but they would have come to the same ultimate end. Lars fucked the girl at 1:30 and they met at 1. Lars had his head resting on my belly, his legs around my legs, and I had one hand on his head. Lars had never been so angry at me before, and I was never convinced he cared all that much. But when I saw how I had hurt him, I was surprised, for I obviously mean more to him than I thought. Lars has absolute power, and I have none, and he doesn't reply to my emails, and I am unable to reach him because his phone is broken. Lars has become unenthusiastic in his contact with me since leaving here yesterday. Lars has been holding himself apart from me, which is hard. Lars has been just as secretive, just as guarded, and just as unreliable as he was all summer, telling me that his girlfriend is going to go to Mexico with him, then in the next email saying, or maybe not. Lars is a beautiful man. Lars is not going to write me back either because he is a selfish and uncaring person or because I'm a bad and selfish person. Lars is not interested in being your boyfriend or your husband ever. Lars is not interested in you. Lars is not superior to any man. Lars is not superior to any of my friends. Lars is reticent and secretive and private. Lars is self-absorbed and self-pitying. Lars is so beautiful, and I love having him in bed with me. Lars is so truly not in love with me. Lars is the sort who will always leave. Lars once told me that it would scare women how much he thought about fucking other women. Lars only excited the female parts of me, while the male parts of me weren't into him, didn't like him, didn't respect him. Lars passed me his phone. There had been a choir on the streetcar earlier, and he had recorded it on his phone. So that's Elle, and then I'll read some other. Well, does anyone have a letter that they want to hear? Q is one sentence. But I can tell you, it's the one chapter I've memorized. Q is quiet days, not seeing people, feeling fine. Which is a very aspirational sentence.
I like W.
W.
I like all the questioning.
Okay. I'll read some of W and then we can go back to talking. Well, it starts with walking. Okay. Walk more and be outside more. Walking home from the party, I was upset, thinking Agnes had it all because she had a husband and now she could have a kid while I had nothing. Walking to the bar where I was going to think about my future, it seemed like it would be good to have the novel done by February. Walking to the Price Chopper yesterday, he asked me if we had ever before walked together when there was snow on the ground. Walking up the street last night, I saw myself as stepping off a spinning wheel. Walking was also falling. Walking with him in the bookstore, we were talking and looking at books, and I spotted the literary fiction section. And it suddenly seemed like the smallest thing in the world. Not at all this huge thing or the most important thing in the world, but like some precious cabal with a lot of self-importance. Wandering and wandering. Wandering in Toronto. Wandering just this little patch of earth. Wanting to be open to whatever the future might bring. Wanting to be protected. Wanting to control something that cannot be controlled. Wanting to cry. Was he sexist? Was I 16? Was it only Tuesday when we had steak tartare at Le Poisson Rouge and Pavel cried and I cried too? Was it too late to be loving? Was it worth it to be doubtful, to be so paralyzed with doubt? We agreed that he was smart, maybe the smartest person we knew. We all do different things well and pick up on and admire most in others the qualities we do not have in ourselves. We all have our vanity. We are all connected. We are always loyal to the wrong people. We are just a couple of adults having a good time, he said. We are sitting here in bed and he is writing a letter, but even if he didn't have a letter to write, the morning wouldn't have moved towards sex. We are unique little planets. We ate a lot of nice food, green beans and mussels and potato kugel and red cabbage, and neither of us mentioned wine. We just drank water. We ate our shrimp risotto on the couch. Then he quietly and carefully brought up the idea that we should go to couples therapy together.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite letter in the book?
Everyone asked me this.
Yeah, do they?
I think Q is really a nice one. I is my least favorite letter. Mm. That was the hardest chapter because it was so long. And it was just like impossibly long. I could have let it take over the whole book.
Yeah, and you ended up splitting it in half, right?
Because it was so long.
Beginning again.
Yeah. So there's like all the sentences that begin with I, like the subject I, and then I made a space break for the poor reader and then started again with ice cream was served, which was the first word that started with I, not I.
Yeah, I was listening to it as an audiobook and then also reading along. And the I chapter of the audiobook was, I think, an hour and 20 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, I is thick, but it was also one of my favorite chapters because it is so of the self. And I found it the place where I was really getting to know the speaker voice or your voice quite well.
And the audiobook is interesting because Kate Berlant, the comic, did it. And I love her work. She did a comedy special called Cinnamon in the Wind, which is... I show it to everybody who comes over. So I was very happy to have her do the audiobook.
Yeah. So I was the least favorite. That was
a, it was hard. It was just difficult. Yeah.
I'm curious about whether there was a favorite moment for you, a favorite discovery that you made between sentences that just worked so well together or were so funny together. That was kind of like an aha, oh my God, this is perfect. I love the way this has worked out.
I can't remember any off the top of my head, but that was always like the fun and the thrill of doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was what was exciting about making it.
I imagine the process of putting together this book, a book with that has, you know, comes from existing text versus a book where you're generating new material would be quite different. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a friend, great writer Nazba Tom. They asked me a couple of weeks ago about my writer body, which is like the physicality that you inhabit as you're writing. You know, the way that you're sitting, the way that you're breathing, how you feel in your body. So I guess I'm curious if you've ever sort of thought about this, or if you have a different writer body for when you are, you know, manipulating existing material or editing versus when you're generating new material?
That's an interesting question. I haven't thought about that expression. I always work in bed. so my writer body is very warm and lazy and comfortable and cozy. I was editing this during the years that I was writing Motherhood and Pure Color. So it was less the body, I think, that shifted than what I wanted to do with my mind that day. Like, did I want to go into the heavy emotional space of like these books that I was generating and that were hard to write and emotional? And Or did I feel like editing and playing and doing kind of a puzzle? It was kind of like doing a crossword puzzle. Yeah. For years, my boyfriend called it my procrastination project. And that's kind of what it felt like. It was like, I feel like working, but I don't feel like doing the hard work. So I'll do this more front of the brain work, you know, when you're like writing fiction or you're sort of in the sort of a, you're in the back of your brain in this kind of more dreamlike space.
Yeah.
Kind of more of a trance. Whereas this felt more like front of the brain, like letters and words.
Yeah. A lot of people talk about that, about needing sort of a book to cheat on their other book with.
Right.
So that makes a lot of sense. Or a genre to cheat on their other genre with.
Yeah. It's better kind of cheating than the other kind. I mean, it's just so hard.
It happens a bit in the book as well.
Yeah. No, it's just hard to like have something. I can't write fiction every day. I've never been able to even work every day because I find it so... I think I only like writing when I really feel like writing, and I don't feel like writing very often because it is such a way of being away from the world, and I really like being in the world. And so it's more like, and I also think with writing fiction for me, like I like to feel like the energy building up, like the desire to write, like I want to kind of like have a lust to write and like be away from it for a few weeks and then start looking forward to it rather than the opposite, which is like, okay, here's my job and every day I'm going to write. I want to like look forward to it like something delicious.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. So chapter F ends with this sentence, funny how I didn't see this at the time. So what I want to know is what kinds of things, either about yourself or about others or about art or beauty, did viewing your diaries in this new manipulated way allow you to see that you couldn't see before?
Yeah, it's a really good question. A few things. So about myself, I think just how narrow and limited I am, which was upsetting at first, because one wants to think that they're like kaleidoscopic in everything and everybody, and there's like this hunger to be huge. And I think like in our culture especially, there's this pressure to always be expanding and growing and getting better and improving and like stretching. And I think doing this diary, I was like, oh no, you're this sort of small, contained little self. And the self is not about, the self is about repetition. And I think that was sort of surprising and disappointing and then kind of reassuring, like, well, that's okay. It's like you have this little garden, you know? And so that was one thing. And so I think I don't feel, I think I used to feel frustrated by being bound to a self. And now it feels kind of nice and easy. And then in terms of other people, I think another thing about making the characters was, What was interesting was how easy it was to make up new characters from the sentences, which made me think like there's so many personality types that I don't have in my life. And then there's certain personality types which I love to have in my life. And I wasn't quite aware of that. Like pretty much everybody in my life is a very opinionated person, you know, who I look to for answers. And I don't really have any character types or any friends who are more wishy-washy than me. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we're like, we are one thing and we're only drawn to a few things, or at least me.
Yeah.
You know?
Have you found yourself seeking out those things that have appeared to be missing, or?
No.
Nope. No sort of changes to your day-to-day, to your habits
no.
have come out of this?
I don't want friends who know less than me. Or who don't know what they think. No, yeah. I would rather be surrounded by like strong personalities that I can sort of be a shape. You know, like if the people around you all are so strong, then you who feel sort of shapeless can sort of have a shape in between all of them. Mm-hmm. If all the people around me were as shapeless as me, then I would just like be a puddle on the floor.
One of those very strong characters who comes through is Hanif, whose
right.
section is very, there's a lot of very sound advice given that the narrator seems to really respect and listen to. And one of those lines here is, Hanif considers writing in a diary writing exclamation point.
Yeah.
So when you first wrote that in your diary, do you recall if you also considered writing in a diary writing, and has that changed now?
No, I had a lot of contempt for that idea. And I still don't really consider it writing. I mean, I think editing is writing. Like, I think what I did in writing this book was to edit it. That was the writing. But I still think the writing was just... But then on the other hand, like, I do take a lot of writing that wasn't intended to be in a book and use it in my books. But again, I think that the writing in that case is the editing and the selecting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you still keep a diary?
Sometimes. I don't feel as much compulsion to now that I've betrayed myself and published my diary. I don't trust myself. Like, why would I write anything down in a diary anymore? But once in a while, I have to. You know, if I need to talk to a friend, yeah, and all my friends are asleep, then I'll revert to the diary. But yeah.
Yeah, so there are no plans for alphabetical diaries?
No.
To
No, I hope not.
Yeah. All right. What is... I guess, what is your relationship to the diaries as they existed originally, now that you have kind of cut them up and pasted them in this new form?
I mean, they're still there on my computer. The only time I ever look back at them is when, once in a while, I'll be sort of bored and I'll be like, what's today? February 21st?
Yes.
Yeah. And then I'll be like, what was I doing on February 21st? In 10 years ago or 12 years ago. And I'll that'll be kind of fun to see, you know. That's kind of a fun game that I'll do every, like, once in a while, once, yeah, or twice a year. But mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't really look at them.
Oh, I can't relate to that. I feel like I go back and read any diary entry I've written from the beginning of time, like, every 6 months. And I don't know why. Maybe just to remind myself where I've come from, or maybe it is self-indulgent.
So you're constantly reading your old, yes, diaries? Wow.
Yes, I am.
What? Wow.
Should I not have admitted that?
What are you learning? No, that's really fascinating. What are you learning from them, do you think? Or why do you return to them?
I'm not sure I'm learning anything. I think I'm just cringing at myself or shaming myself.
It's just masochism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
I don't believe that. I think there's something else to it.
There may be. Maybe I need to do a little more self-interrogation. But
that's really interesting. That's nice. No, that seems like a really beautiful kind of intimacy with yourself.
Mm. Well, thank you for framing it that way instead of the narcissism angle. I think what's really cool about this book is it allows people who have been following your work and your career for a long time to get a glimpse of the real thing that was happening while you were writing some of their favorite books. Mm. So I'm curious about how you see your relation, or how you see this book's relationship to all of the work that has come before it. And could this one exist now without the others? Could it have come earlier? How do you see it fitting into sort of like all of, you know, Sheila Hetty's work?
I don't think I've really thought about it, honestly. This is just the background, like you just put it. But I don't think I was thinking about that when I was editing it, you know, or putting it into the world. I mean, I had a contract to publish this in 2013, and it wouldn't have been ready. It would have been a completely different book. It wouldn't have been so good. I knew it wasn't ready, and I didn't publish it. But I think if I published it then, it would have been... people wouldn't have liked it so much. I think that it would have felt like self-indulgent in a way that, like, once you've written a number of books, then maybe people sort of trust you a little bit more, right, rather than just they're irritated by you, which felt very much the kind of the reaction in the early days, mm-hmm, especially after How Should a Person Be? Mm-hmm. And now it just feels like more of like a grown-up decision to do this rather than like a youthful showing off or something.
Yeah.
It's weird how perception changes through a career. I didn't know that was going to happen, and it's, mm-hmm, interesting to see it.
Nice.
People give you the benefit of the doubt a little bit more, yeah, as the years go by.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for answering my questions. I had about 60 that I needed to whittle down. And I'm just very, very grateful that you took the time and the energy to humor me a little bit. And I'd love to give our audience a chance to ask some questions of Sheila as well. If there's anything that has piqued your interest that you would like to ask of Sheila. Yes. Great. So the question is, the book was ordered alphabetically rather than chronologically. And did that make a difference when you read it back?
Yeah, I mean, I never really, if you read it alphabetically, you're not really reading it, you know, because you're not really getting the scenes. I'm not like Molly reading my diary.
Not like that loser.
I have like read it like chronologically, and it is interesting, but it's a completely different experience. Like if you're reading it chronologically, you have all the feelings that you had at the time, you know, and you're really reliving those moments. But if you read it alphabetically, that doesn't happen. I think that's why it was an easy project to do on the side, because it wasn't, you know, reading these scenes and feeling ashamed and feeling like whatever. It was very technical. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for your question. Anyone else? Yes.
The question was, yeah, whether I read the audiobook for Pure Color and Motherhood, but not this one. Why? I just didn't want to. Like, I didn't want to read every page. I was so, not that I wasn't sick of the other books by the time I was done, but I was sick of this one in a different way. Yeah.
Thank you. Great. Yes. Awesome question. So, this person in the front row here is commenting on how Sheila said she likes to have a lust for writing to be able to get into it. And so the question is, has that always been the case? Or, you know, was there a time early on when there was, you know, you felt the pressure to produce?
Every day, yeah. So I read a lot of interviews with writers when I was younger, the Paris Review interviews when I was a teenager. I was really interested, like, how does a person do this? And many people have a daily routine. And so, yeah, when I was younger, I thought I need a daily routine, and I tried. And I just couldn't. I can't do anything every day. I can't do yoga every day. I'm just not that kind of person at all. I get really, I like variety. And then I started, I was in my university days, and I was thinking, well, I do need some kind of discipline, but for me, the discipline is going to be when I feel like writing, I have to write. So then I would like not go to class if I felt like writing, or if I woke up in the middle of the night and I felt like writing, I'd have to write. So I was like, I do think there has to be hard work and discipline, but there's different kinds. And then I started like seeing more and more as I read more and more about artists and artists' lives and processes, that it tended to be the men that worked every day. And the women had a more organic kind of relationship to work. And I thought, well, I'm a woman. Maybe I could try that. And then I remember reading this quote. I think it was E.B. White. I think this, I put this in How Should a Person Be? And he said something like, if a literary man feels like going to the zoo, he should by all means go to the zoo. And so then I thought, well, discipline can mean lots of things. Like maybe if what I really feel like doing is watching reality TV, that's what I should do. And that's, you know, and just really trying to follow every instinct. And if the instinct is not to write, to follow that, and just to trust every instinct. And, you know, like I've been working with chatbots, and I was like in the summer of 2022, just talking a lot to chatbots, and I felt really guilty, and I felt like I should be writing my next book. I'm wasting my time. But I'm having so much fun and I feel so guilty. And that's like, to me, discipline. It's like the discipline of like doing this thing that feels bad, that feels like a waste of time. I don't know, that to me, that, and I think that's the, and I think that's the only way to make interesting work, is if you're like, if you have a lust for it, you know? And also I think the other thing about like not writing every day, like if you write every day, you're just putting out, I don't know, like what I like about not writing every day is that all the energy start building up. And so it's like, okay, so you had this weird dream, and then you had this weird conversation, and then you saw that thing on the street, and all those things start mixing together. And then when you write after 2 weeks, you have like 2 weeks of interesting things that are all swirling about together that will then come out in the writing altogether. Whereas if you're writing every day, like there's not that much mixing up in your head. So I have a lot of thoughts about that question. Yeah.
Great question. I have a follow-up. Do you take sort of scheduled breaks from writing between books, or are you always kind of, you know, watching for the lust that comes?
I don't make myself take breaks because I take breaks quite naturally.
Me too.
Yeah.
I'm on a 3-year long break right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other questions from our audience? Yes. Yeah. Awesome. Great question. It is, the question is, the classification of whether this is fiction or nonfiction, was that an editorial decision, or does Sheila have a preference of how this book is classified?
I mean, it makes, I really like the classification book. not to be glib, but I really think that's just what it is. Like, that's what I like making books. I don't really care if it's fiction or nonfiction or some mixture or memoir. Like, to me, it's just, I love books, you know, and I've always loved books. And you know, I tried to write a movie at one time. Somebody wanted me to help them out with it. I just don't care about, I like watching movies, but I don't care about them. Like, I care about books. And so, and I don't really care about novels more than, like, a good cookbook can actually be, like, sort of amazing. And, you know, a dictionary can be kind of amazing. And so I really wish there didn't have to be any of that. Like, why can't the books in the bookshelf, in the library or whatever, just be, or the bookstore, alphabetical by the author's name, say? You know, I think that it's a marketing thing. Like, is this fiction? Is this nonfiction? Everything is both. You know, our lives are both. Like, we have these physical bodies, but then we have these imaginations that give meaning to them. Like, is life fiction or nonfiction? Like, it seems funny to have this distinction you have to make with literature. And, you know, I think about poetry, and they don't say, well, this poem is memoir, and this poem is fiction, and this poem is nonfiction. Like, with poetry or music, you know, or stand-up comedy, we understand that the self and the imagination both contribute to what's there. But I somehow, with books, it's something different. I understand for journalism, like, you have to say, like, this is journalism. But for the other stuff, I think I'd rather not. We don't have to. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting what you're saying about poetry being given this, I guess, a benefit of the doubt, or being free from fiction or nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And I found that reading your book, it very much read like poetry, especially at right. times of that repetition. I'm curious, were you reading poetry at the time of editing, or were you thinking about this work as poetry in some way?
No, I don't read as much poetry as some of my friends do. I really just like paragraphs and chapters, and that's really what I like. I don't know. I don't know. I just really like novels and nonfiction and books. Poetry to me it takes a certain kind of patience. And as a reader, I like reading very fast. Mm. For a very long time, the book, every sentence was on its own line. So it was not really like poetry. It was more like a list. And then I had this designer, Lisa Naftalin, and my friend Leanne Shapton look at it, and Lisa put it all in one paragraph. And that was the first time I started to think of it as a novel and as a narrative more than a list. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, for sure, poetry was something in my head, in the sense of, like, well, and music, like repetition, rhythm. Mm-hmm. But I think about those things with all the books too.
I'm taking over this Q&A because I have one more question about that. You mentioned sort of you like to read things quite quickly.
Yeah.
When you thought of your imagined reader, was there a pace at which you thought that they should move through the book? Yeah. Did you want them to sort of let things wash over them, or pay, you know, very close attention to individual images and connections?
I thought people would read it fast, and then people are telling me sometimes that they're reading it very slowly.
Oh, I read it so slowly.
Yeah.
Yes. But I also have a poet's brain, so I think I was really zoning into individual connections between sentences and trying to, you know, connecting a sentence way at the top of the page to one on the next page, because there is so much in there. There is a lot of real minutia, really cool stuff happening. And I took a lot of time moving through it. So yeah, I just wondered, you know, hearing you say you like to read things quickly, I was like, should I have read this book completely differently?
I had a friend tell me like she read a chapter, a letter every night, you know, and I was like, oh, that's sort of nice.
Yeah.
But I guess that's not so different. People often read a chapter a night of a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It seems, now that I'm saying it, doesn't seem very special.
It is special, I think, just because of the nature of the chapters being letters in the alphabet. Yeah. It is sort of a magical, playful space. All right, back to you folks. Yes. Yeah, so the question is about categorizing the book as fiction or creative nonfiction, and whether that's sort of a regional thing, you know, this idea of it being marketed as fiction here and as nonfiction in the UK.
Yeah, the publisher in the UK is Fitzcarraldo Editions, who publish a lot of avant-garde writing. They publish Annie Ernaux, who won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, and they have blue books for fiction and white books for nonfiction. And I always imagined this would be a blue book, fiction with white lettering. And the publisher wanted it to be a white book with blue lettering because in the nonfiction category, because he said that the British book review press has a very conservative ideas of what a novel is. And that if we publish this as fiction, as a novel, they're all gonna hate it and be very frustrated. Well, this doesn't have all these other qualities that novels have. Whereas if they publish it as nonfiction, it'll be accepted. And he pointed out that Annie Ernaux, who writes about her life in a novelistic way, is in white. And I thought, well, Annie Ernaux won the Nobel Prize. Go ahead, publish it in white. But in my head, it's still blue in the UK. And then here, the reason they published the novel is because I'm like, it's a novel. I mean, if you have to call it something, just call it a novel. Because I wanted it to work like a novel. I wanted it to have characters and voice and narrative and, you know, in all the ways that I can in this form. In the US, they just call it literary collections. So I don't know. And, you know, and I think it's a little weird to have it so differently characterized, but.
Yeah, I don't know. Great. Thanks for expanding on that. We have a question from our online audience. The audiobook is read by comedian Kate Berlant, as you mentioned. How did that collaboration come about? Did you have any stake in that, sort of choosing the person who would represent that?
She's a friend of mine. I always like working with friends as much as possible. I had other friends that I was also talking to, but then when I mentioned to Kate, she was so enthusiastic, and she said she'd actually been reading it out loud when she was reading the manuscript. And so I was like, this is perfect. She could do it. The timing worked out, and so it was great. It's interesting with Pure Color, I had a bunch of different friends I wanted to read it, and I got them all to send in tapes of them reading it, friends I had in theater school and friends from my childhood and everything like that. And then the publisher rejected everything and said, we want you to read it. So this is the first time I've been able to have a friend read a book, and I'm happy about that.
Oh, great. Yeah, I saw there's a poet in Vancouver, Sherita Warner, at her last book launch. She had her friends who were seated in the audience stand up at certain points and read a stanza or a line.
That's nice.
And it was a really beautiful kind of symphony of just the people she cared most about, just kind of rising out of the audience and joining her in that recitation. So I understand that sort of want to engage with the people who are important to you and bring them in to your work.
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions from our audience here? Great question. So the question is, after writing this book, has your relationship to writing diary entries changed? Do you become more self-conscious?
No, I don't think so. I think it's always just, I don't think of it as a formal thing when I'm writing a diary. It's just, I got to get this down for some reason. Either it's something I want to remember or it's something I'm trying to work through, but no, it hasn't changed that much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, at the back.
Yeah. Mm,
yeah. So the question is, by, you know, putting the sentences in alphabetical order, you bring them out of time. So how did that make you feel about time? And actually, this was a question that I had as well, because I wanted to bring up this idea of the soul of time from motherhood. Right. And I was curious about whether there was a link between the soul of time and sort of the function of time in this book.
That's a really great question. I mean, what's weird about the book is that it feels so much like life, even though it's not chronological, even though it's alphabetical. And I was thinking a lot about time and how to come this works, you know? And I think part of the reason it works is because although our bodies do appear to move through time chronologically, in our minds, we aren't moving through time chronologically. Like we sort of move in and out of the present and move into the past. And, you know, if we think about a person that we know, we have all these different selves of them kind of overlapping on top of each other. It's there's so much compounding of instants and the you know, the future and the past and the present all kind of mixed up all together. And so it sort of feels in some ways more like realism than a lot of the narrative stuff that I've written or read because of that. Because it is like, our minds don't really experience time the way our bodies do, you know? And like I said before, like there is this kind of static self or something. There's like the way that that your life is just this complete orb, you know? And it's not so different 10 years ago than now. I mean, the circumstances may be different. Maybe there's health problems. Maybe there's all sorts of different things, but there's something really at the core of it all that is not different. Like the eye, more or less, at least for me, the last 10 years feels like it stayed pretty constant. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you for that question. We had one over here. Yes. Yeah. So the question is about using Microsoft Excel for this project. And if you have anything to say about tackling that beast.
Well, it's the opposite of difficult and tedious, because I did find and replace, put every sentence on its own line, like find period, replace with period, paragraph marks, look for question mark, replace with question mark, paragraph mark. So every sentence became on its own line after I put them all in the same document. And then I imported into Excel, which took about 12 seconds. And then there's a button that said A to Z, and that took about 3 seconds. And so it was not tedious for me. I mean, maybe it was tedious for the computer, but it was very easy for me. I mean, I love technology. I love spreadsheets. I love all these things that we have at our disposal that allows us to write in different ways. You know, I could not have done this without Microsoft Excel. I could have probably done it with a different spreadsheet program, but I'll give props to Microsoft Excel. I don't know. I like technology. I think it's fun. I mean, it takes away jobs, but it's fun for a writer. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. We have another question from our online audience. Why the alphabet? The process of using the alphabet reminds me of John Cage and introducing randomness and chance to art.
Yeah, I think that's just it. Randomness and chance and what's it called? Constraints. It's, you can't make art without constraints. And it's like, it's just a very, and it is what we use to make our books. It's the alphabet or the letters of the alphabet. So there's something very, and when I was like a kid, we had this like game where we had to in class, like see who could find a word the fastest in the dictionary. And I was sure I would beat everybody and I was terrible at it. So I think it's my revenge, like my taking back the alphabet and doing something. I don't know. I was just like really wrong about that. I think some people know exactly where a letter is in the alphabet, but I'm the kind of person that has to start from A every time.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So yeah, I'd like to try that exercise again with some of those same friends.
Was there ever a temptation to sort them by any other category?
No. I don't know what else. Always how the else, alphabet. How else I would have sorted them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So, yes, right here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the question is about whether you've thought about the sort of women's tradition of diary writing.
It's a good question. I guess so in the sense of, yeah, like Anais Nin's diaries were really important to me when I was like younger. And yeah, I think there was something kind of that felt maybe, I actually forgot this, but I think maybe at the beginning of the of this project, when I first started thinking about publishing it, that felt a little rebellious in the sense of like, this is supposed to be such a petty form. And it's, yeah, like you say, such a female form and such a low, you know, low form. And there would be something interesting and funny about putting it out. I mean, there's so many great diaries, like Susan Sontag's diaries are, it's just like some of my favorite things she's ever, she didn't publish it, but that her, that were published by her. Yeah, I think I did think about that and then forget. And I'm glad you brought that up. It's interesting.
Yeah, even just the word diary as opposed to something like journal.
I really wanted that girly word, like diary. Journal. I didn't want it elevated. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lot of us who, you know, have grown up as, you know, emerging writers as women, the bit of feedback that we sometimes get early on is this reads like your diary.
Right.
And it's meant to be an insult to your writing, or that you're being too wishy-washy or self-serving or something. So I really love the title and that you use the word diaries. Did you always refer to them as your diaries?
Yeah.
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 Lovely. Great. Other questions from our audience? Yes.
To me, it's a tool, you know, that you can use. I've worked with it a lot, and I don't see that it is going to be writing books. I mean, maybe it's going to be writing really bad books, but it has no need to communicate, you know, and it has no experience, and it has no aesthetic. It just doesn't have any of the things that an artist needs to make art. And I also just think like we're interested in it now because it's new, but you don't want to know what a computer is going to make. Like, you want to know what another human is going to make. Like, I really think like ultimately once we get over the fascination with it, and again, maybe they'll do very easily reproducible forms of art, but like real artists, like the reason you go to art is because you want to connect with another soul. Like, the reason I read books is because I want to be close to the person that wrote the book. I want to be in their mind. I want to be in their soul. Like, I like them. They're a friend. Like, you'll never get that from a computer writing a book. And I think one of the reasons also we like art is because it's amazing that somebody made this. Like, it's just like watching an athlete. Like, you could get a computer or a robot to run faster than a human, and it'll be interesting to watch the first time, you know, they beat us. But then it's not interesting because a human didn't do it. Like, we want to see all the effort that went into training and all the sacrifice that went into training and like the human body. Like, I don't think we're that interested. I don't think we're going to be interested in computers, ultimately, what they can do with art or bodies or whatever. So I don't feel that there's any, I don't feel threatened by it. And I'm just like, how can I use this and have fun? And, you know, how can it help me rather than like, who is this? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Have you played around much with AI software?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I was obsessed with it for a summer, and then, you know, it's like, it has no inner life.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that interesting. Mm-hmm. It's cool. And then the novelty kind of wears off. You know?
That is a comforting thought, that this is sort of a temporary plaything moment for us rather than this entity that's going to ruin art.
Well, it's like a kitchen appliance. It's like getting like a great kitchen appliance, mm-hmm. where you're like, this is going to be amazing. I'm always going to make like, you know, noodles out of my vegetables. And then you do that for a month and you're like going back to like cutting your vegetables. I don't know.
You know, I do have this really amazing avocado cutting tool that I thought would be one of those things that I would scrap in like 2 weeks, but I use it all the time. If you ever see one of those things that's like, it's got the stripes where you can slice it, and it's got the little knife and the little thing where you like take the pit out, get it. It would change your life. We have time for one more question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at what stage did you decide to integrate characters and start doing this like amalgamation of people?
Yeah.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. at a certain point, I thought the only way to publish the book is to take out all the names. And so I just used like he and she and whatever, like everyone was, had no name. And I showed it to a friend of mine and I thought this book is, it's more interesting now. And she thought it was less interesting. And so I was like, okay, so I do need characters. And what was fun about making the characters is because like there's not very many ways you can make a plot in a book like this. But the way you can make a plot is have like the worst boyfriends have names at the beginning of the alphabet and the better boyfriends have names at the end of the alphabet. So it seems like I've had this arc, so that's what I did. Like, and that's, and I was like, oh, there's all these little tricks you can do, you know, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, that puzzling thing. I definitely, the whole time I was reading, I just kept having the thought, this would be so much fun to write. And I was feeling really jealous of you the whole time that I had not been more diligent in my diary writing. Because I do think that it must have been a pretty delightful experience.
It was both. It was fun. And at other times it was like frustrating. Yeah. And like, will I ever figure out like what this is supposed to be, you know? Yeah. But yeah, it was fun.
Do you feel sad that it's over?
No.
Nope. Beautiful.
Quite glad.
Done and dusted.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sheila,
thank
for answering our questions. Thank you to all of you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers Fest. To hear more events like this one and view our upcoming events, visit our website at writersfest.bc.ca.